Hello and welcome to the Magazine Rack. I'm Chris. I'm Mario Cajar, and today I'll be reading from a special Olympics preview issue of Sports Illustrated magazine and from the Sports Illustrated website, SI.com. First up is an article by L. John Wertheim titled, Let the Games Begin. It is the city of light and the city of sights. No matter who's judging the competition, it takes its place on the medal stand for the mythical title of world's most visually beautiful city. But this spring, Paris has been a city for ears as much as for the eyes. Drowning out the accordions, the soundtrack is one of clanging, the hum of construction. Yeah, some of this audio comes from Notre Dame, where renovations are happily, and uncharacteristically for the French, proceeding on schedule, repairing the damage caused by a 2019 fire on the world's most famous cathedral. Most of Paris's noise, however, emanates from the structures being jerry-built for the 2024 Summer Olympics. On the lawns behind the Eiffel Tower, along the banks of the Seine, finishing touches are being applied to a temporary 13,000-seat structure that will host the beach volleyball competition. Not far away on the other side of the river, bleachers are being installed at the Place de la Concorde for the venue to host urban sports like BMX freestyle, skateboarding, and, mon Dieu, the first Olympic breakdancing, officially known as breaking, competition. In the suburbs of Saint-Denis, work is afoot on the Olympic Village for some 15,000 athletes, which will be used for low-income housing after the Games. About 10 miles outside of town in the other direction, the grounds at the Palace at Versailles are framed by bleachers to accommodate 40,000 fans for the equestrian events. A year ago, you could have spent time in Paris and heard nary a bulldozer, scarcely realizing the next Olympics were coming to town. We are, after all, talking Paris. Not exactly the kind of place that needs 16 days of global sports to justify itself as a city of the world. If other hosts perceive the Games as a seminal moment in their city's history, Paris seems to be taking one for the team, the Olympic movement, that is. After the systematic Russian doping scandal in Sochi and cost overruns in Rio, the absence of fans and one-year COVID-19 delay in Tokyo, followed by a buzz-deprived Winter Games in authoritarian China, here was Paris to restore dignity and stability to the proceedings. It was met with the famous Gallic "Phew." The overall vibe was perhaps akin to Jimmy Kimmel hosting the Oscars, and I quote, "They need me more than I need the gig, but I'll do it for the sake of the institution," end quote. Locals made vacation plans for late July and early August of 2024, listing their flats on Airbnb and predicting traffic and strikes and general chaos. Even politicians abandoned cheerleading to adopt a defensive procedure. Let's try to stay on budget and avoid a terror attack. But this spring, in lockstep with the venue construction, Olympic enthusiasm undeniably has ramped up. Large rings adorn Paris's city hall. There are pop-up souvenir shops. Athletes, French ones in particular, are featured on billboards and ads in the metro. From hotels to nail salons, businesses are anticipating the premium prices they'll charge. Paris 2024 chief Tony Estanguet, a three-time Olympic gold medalist in canoe slalom, is a media fixture, alternately lifting morale. Preparations are in good shape. And reassuring minds, the security apparatus will be unprecedented. Paris, of course, has done this drill before. Pierre de Coubertin, father of the modern games, envisioned the 1924 Olympics as a way to show Paris's beauty and innovation while also protecting France's robustness after World War I. There was a velodrome with stands designed by Gustave Eiffel, he of the famous tower, and the first athlete's village where most of the 3,000-plus competitors stayed for the duration, enjoying the free hairdresser and catered meals before returning home on trains and steamships. Though Coubertin liked to declare the Olympics a display of manly virtue, These games were open to 135 female athletes in three events, swimming, diving, and tennis, a notable progressive increase from previous Olympiads. Assorted records were smashed in 1924, although in times it would not even make qualifying thresholds today. The heroes included the Flying Finn, Paavo Nurmi, who won gold in the 1500 meters, and then, an hour later, in the 5000. British runners Harold Abraham and Eric Lindell, a Jew and a Protestant, won gold in track, their unlikely feats memorialized in the film Chariots of Fire. Before becoming a Hollywood star portraying Tarzan, American swimmer Johnny Weissmuller won three gold medals in swimming and a bronze in water polo. In a battle between nostalgia and practicality, there will be only modest overlap between Paris 1924 and Paris 2024. Both inside of France and outside to the IOC, one of the great selling points of the Paris bid was the abundance of pre-existing venues, the few temporary structures being assembled now notwithstanding. But only a few are older than a century. The Stadium Colombe, which hosted everything from track to soccer in 1924, was renamed the Stade Yves du Mémoire shortly after those games and was recently renovated to host field hockey this summer. The Tourelle Pool, grandiose when it was inaugurated that summer a century ago as the first dedicated Olympic aquatic facility, will be used only as a practice pool. In addition to the Athletes' Village, only two new permanent venues were constructed for these games, the Aquatic Center in Saint-Denis and the Les Bourget climbing venue. Organizers are also hopeful that the Seine will play a much different role in 2024 than it did 100 years ago. Like an athlete listed as day-to-day, the river's status for 2024 remains uncertain. Roughly $1.5 billion has been invested in a filtration system, rainwater storage tanks, and the extraction of bikes and scooters from the river bottom. The opening ceremony would, for the first time in modern Olympic history, move out of a conventional stadium and be staged flotilla-style along the river. More than 600,000 fans, roughly the entire attendance of the 1924 games, would line the embankments for 6 kilometers in order to watch. These ambitions have been scaled back considerably, though. Owing to security concerns and expenses, the crowd of 600,000 for the opening ceremony has been pared down to 325,000, about 105,000 paid and 220,000 given free tickets via lottery. In the spring, there were talks of a Plan B, a literal course correction, whereby the ceremony ends up at the main stadium, the Stade de France in Saint-Denis. In fairness, by the way, the bid was prepared before the wars in Ukraine and Gaza. What's more, the contaminants that have tainted the river for more than a century have proven stubborn to remove. With the games fast approaching, French officials were feeling very confident, as they put it, after unveiling an underground reservoir near the city's Austerlitz railroad station that can collect as much as 20 Olympic-sized swimming pools worth of rain and wastewater as a way of preventing sewage from overflowing into the river. Anyhow, no matter what the river status, Paris, as host of this summer's Olympics, is likely to be music to the ears of many. You are listening to the Magazine Rack on Chris. The next article is by Chris Mannix, and it's titled Smoke Show. 30 years ago, the scene would have been familiar. Mike Tyson addressing a packed room before a big fight. A lot has changed since then, since Tyson was the undisputed heavyweight champion, snarling through interviews and cartoonishly knocking out overmatched opponents. And yet, inside the Apollo Theater, where fans lined the Harlem streets for hours to cram into a press conference to promote Tyson's upcoming fight against Jake Paul, one thing was clear. Tyson can still draw a crowd. But for what, exactly? Tyson versus Paul, which will pit the 57-year-old Tyson, who hasn't fought in an official match in 19 years, against Paul, 27, a YouTuber-turned-boxer who has fattened his resume, flattening ex-mixed martial art fighters, is something of a mystery. It's a sanctioned fight, meaning the results will go on each fighter's record. It isn't a typical one. Tyson versus Paul will be contested over 8 2-minute rounds instead of the traditional 3, with both fighters wearing 14-ounce gloves instead of the more puncher-friendly 10. Tyson called the decision to make the fight a no-brainer and something I want to do, as he put it. And why? Tyson will tell you that he still has the itch that Paul called him out and, hey, he had to respond. More likely, Tyson's motives are purely financial. He will be paid 7 figures to face Paul, but that's just the beginning of the event's earning potential. Tyson used the press conference to push a new energy boost product. He wore a t-shirt promoting a Las Vegas law firm. These days, Tyson's portfolio includes a cannabis company, an apparel line, and a podcast. A fight with Paul, which will stream worldwide exclusively on Netflix, offers Tyson a chance to bump his brand in front of tens of millions of new eyeballs. Mike is no dummy, says Lou DiBella, a veteran boxing promoter and former HBO executive. He understands the economic power and the reach of the combination of himself and Jake Paul. He made an incredible business decision. Indeed, Tyson has made many of them. In 2005, when he retired following a second straight loss, his future looked bleak. He had been $38 million in debt with no clear way to dig himself out. Most people, says DiBella, thought it was going to end badly. Tyson could always make a little cash. Someone would always want to do a sponsorship deal with him, says former Tyson manager Shelley Finkel. But the idea that Tyson could emerge as a business tycoon seemed about as far-fetched as another run as heavyweight champ. And yet, here we are. Tyson has always understood marketing. In 2002, a melee broke out during his press conference with Lennox Lewis after Tyson bit his ankle. Finkel recalls a conversation he had with Tyson immediately after. He grabbed me and said, "Shelley, this fight's going to be bigger than ever," says Finkel. "All I'm thinking is, how do I get him licensed? How do I clean up this mess?" But he knew what happened there only made the fight bigger. Those around Tyson credit his wife, Lakeija. Kiki, whom Tyson married in 2009, has helped harness the Tyson brand. "She's very astute," says DiBella. A cameo in The Hangover, where Tyson played a Phil Collins singing, tiger-owning parody of himself, flashed a different side of him. Undisputed Truth, his Spike Lee-directed one-man show, humanized him. As marijuana has been mainstreamed, Tyson has capitalized, opening a 40-acre ranch in the Mojave Desert to grow his bud, apparently named Tyson 2.0. After having been fined $3 million for biting Evander Holyfield's ear in 1997, Tyson claims he has made more than that from pictures of himself doing the same thing to others. "I don't dwell on what was," said Tyson. "I had so much, but I could do so little. Now I can do so much." Hot Boxin', his YouTube podcast in which a sublimely stoned Tyson banters, often incomprehensibly with a guest, attracts A-list celebs. Entertainers like Wiz Khalifa, Rick Ross, and Kevin Hart. Athletes like Francis Ngannou, Tyson Fury, and Dennis Rodman. What begins with Tyson interviewing a subject invariably ends with them questioning him. Inside a cramped trailer, Eminem and Tyson bonded over the shared understanding of what it took to get to the top. "It's almost like you have to give your happiness up to accomplish your goal," said Tyson, as one of the world's most famous rappers nodded knowingly. Last summer, Paul made an appearance on the podcast. Tyson praised Paul for the attention he was bringing boxing and for his efforts to increase fighter pay. "Life is about pimping and hoeing," said Tyson, "and fighters are the whores." In 2020, Paul splashed onto the boxing scene, knocking out former NBA player Nate Robinson on the undercard of Tyson's exhibition against Roy Jones Jr. "I want to thank you for that opportunity," said Paul. 4 years later, he's getting another. Buddy McGirt has a story. In 2003, McGirt, a Hall of Fame trainer, worked Clifford Etienne's corner for his fight against Tyson. In the hours leading into the match, Etienne was confident, cocky even. 8 months earlier, Lewis had knocked out Tyson. Etienne was certain he would do the same thing. When Tyson entered the ring, he ripped the towel off his shoulders and threw it at Etienne's feet. In that moment, says McGirt, I could see Cliff's soul leave his body. Tyson knocked out Etienne in 49 seconds. Paul expects a similar feeling. Tyson's affection for Paul is evident. Paul, a heel by nature, has done his best to antagonize Tyson. He has mocked Tyson's age, dismissed his power, and insisted it will be Tyson, not himself, who gets knocked out. They say he's the baddest man on the planet, said Paul. Well, let's find out. Tyson, meanwhile, has called Paul a friend and a kid goat. Asked if he intended to put an end to Paul, Tyson said, and I quote, I like Jake a lot. Bizarrely and graphically, declaring that videos of a 16-year-old Paul on YouTube made him physically aroused. Pressed on his own physique, flashed in bite-sized clips on social media, Tyson said his body feels like shit. Asked if he was just playing possum, Tyson said, I wish I was. Still, it's Mike freaking Tyson. In Dallas, on the second stop of the Tyson-Paul press tour, Tyson wondered if Paul was suicidal. Asked why he was confident he could win, Tyson sneered, picture me losing to him. He said Paul's record is filled with little children with no experience. Once he's in that ring, he has to fight like his life is dependent on it, said Tyson, because it will be. None of this is lost on Paul. I'm scared, said Paul. I know it's going to be tough. I know I'm going to have to fight through adversity. I know I might even go to the canvas. Well, maybe he will get up. It won't matter to Tyson. There's no downside to facing Paul. Years ago, Tyson's earning power was tied to his success in the ring. Now it's about the character he's created out of it. You're tuned in to the Magazine Rack on Chris. The next article is by Liam McCune, and it's titled, Meet Hesley Rivera, the 16-year-old gymnast headed to Paris on the U.S. Olympic team. When the Tokyo Olympics took place in the summer of 2021, Hesley Rivera was still in middle school. Just over 2 years ago, in March 2022, she competed at her first international event in Stuttgart, Germany. Last August, she was still competing on the junior level. Her first meet at the senior level was the 2024 Winter Cup in February. Now, the 16-year-old is headed to Paris as part of a historic U.S. Olympic gymnastics team that includes Simone Biles, Suni Lee, Jade Carey, and Jordan Childs, who have won a combined 55 medals at World Championships and the Olympics. It's an incredible moment for the New Jersey native, but it was no sure thing. While the other four members of the team were nearly locked into their spots ahead of the final day of U.S. trials last Sunday, the fifth position was wide open. In the days before and during trials, three top contenders, Skye Blakely, age 19, Shalise Jones, 21, and Kayla DiCello, 20, all suffered injuries and had to drop out of the competition. That opened the door for a lesser-known talent to step up. Rivera was one of the few gymnasts in the hunt for the final spot, and she capitalized on the opportunity Sunday night. Her routine on the uneven bars and balance beam ended up being the difference. She scored a 14.300 on bars at a 6.1 difficulty score and a 14.275 on beam at a 6.0 difficulty score this past Sunday. My mentality was that I had nothing to lose, so I just went out there and did my best. Most importantly, gave it my all, Rivera said, per NBC News. Rivera grew up in Oradell, New Jersey, and trained under Maggie Haney, who coached Lori Hernandez of Final Five fame. By the way, Haney is currently in the midst of a 5-year suspension by USA Gymnastics for verbal and emotional abuse of athletes. Rivera's family moved to Texas, where she entered the World Gymnastics Academy, WOGA, to train under Valerie Liukin, Nastia's father. Rivera has 3 international meets under her belt, including a performance at last year's Junior World Championships that helped Team USA earn a silver medal. But the Olympic environment in Paris will provide a new challenge for the teenager. In a fun contrast, 27-year-old Simone Biles will become the oldest female U.S. gymnast to compete at the Olympics since 1952. Overall, the squad headed to Paris is the oldest and most decorated women's gymnastics team in American history. At the 2024 Winter's Cup, where she competed in the senior division, Rivera finished in 3rd place in the all-around behind DiCello and Blakely. In Paris, 3 gymnasts will be chosen to participate in the team final of events. Any 3-woman combination of Biles, Lee, Childs, and Carey will be chosen for most, but Rivera's slight edge in those categories could get her in the lineup and on the Olympic scoreboard. She may also be called upon to step in if any other member of the team can't perform. The selection committee also said Rivera could represent the U.S. in the games in Los Angeles. For Rivera, making the U.S. Olympic team with her first opportunity, especially at such a young age, is a dream come true. "I was pretty surprised to hear my name," she said, "but I've also been working for this my whole life." This is the Magazine Rack on Chris. Finally, here's an essay by Chris Mannix titled, "Fans in a Frenzy." In his heckling heyday, a 12-year stretch as a Washington Bullets season ticket holder between 1986 and 98, Robin Ficker took on everybody. Established stars like Michael Jordan and Charles Barkley, rising talent like Shaquille O'Neal and Christian Laettner, coaches from Phil Jackson to Frank Layden. From his first row seat, behind the visiting team bench, of course, Ficker, the NBA's most notorious heckler, engaged in what he calls a robust discussion of the issues. Knowing Jordan had claimed he hadn't read the famed book, The Jordan Rules, which highlighted the Bulls' dysfunction, Ficker brought a copy and barked out passages. When O'Neal came to town, Ficker cannibalized the big man's rap song, called "I Know I Got Skills," into "I Got Bills," and proceeded to read a few lines to him. When Jackson became irked by Ficker reading sensitive sections of a book he had written, Ficker suggested Jackson sue himself for libel. The exchanges, says Ficker, could get testy. Layden, then the Jazz coach, once spit at Ficker after Ficker repeatedly reminded Layden of his place on USA Today's worst-dressed coaches list. By the way, Layden, in the aftermath of the incident, denied it, saying, and I quote, "I missed." During timeouts, teams would move their huddles to create space from Ficker, who, armed with a whiteboard, would draw up his own plays and yell them out. In 2005, the NBA codified rules on fan conduct, stating that games will be free from disruptive behavior. Season ticket applications now include language prohibiting fans from engaging in verbal abuse, which Ficker believes was written because of him. "In all his years of heckling," says Ficker, "no player ever demanded his ejection." "Some would get upset," says Ficker, a former attorney who, now at age 81, is running for the U.S. Senate in Maryland as a Republican. "But no one went to a referee or anything like that. It was just talk." According to Ficker, paying customers are entitled to talk. And he stuck to a code. No drinking, no cursing, nothing racial or overly sexual. No talk related to children, unless, of course, they weren't paying child support, says Ficker. Beyond that, anything goes. "Fans are getting a vicarious thrill," he says. "They've had a tough time all week. They imagine they're on the court. They can see the heat of the competition. If they're just saying something, then the players ought to be able to put up with it." Most players today, however, would disagree. The NBA doesn't track fan ejections, but anecdotally, they appear to be on the rise. In February, a fan in Miami was removed from the arena after having a heated argument with Clippers guard Russell Westbrook. A month earlier, Luka Doncic asked security to escort out a Suns supporter heckling him in Dallas. Last season, Doncic's teammate, Kyrie Irving, had an aggressive critic tossed in the third quarter of a game at Charlotte. By the way, it isn't just players. During the regular season, Pistons exec Troy Weaver had a heckler thrown out because the heckler was getting on him about Detroit's lousy season. "I've never believed that just because you buy a ticket you can say whatever you want," says Bucks coach Doc Rivers. "I always think human beings, you still have to be human." So, what's behind the increased tension? "The world is extremely mean right now," says recently fired Lakers coach Darvin Ham. A 10-year NBA veteran, Ham can't recall any tongue-biting experiences with fans in his playing days. "I was a man of the people," he says, "and I was athletic, fast and strong as hell, so I don't know if people wanted to go that route with me." Over the last few years, though, the tone of some of the heckling has changed, which is unfortunate, says Ham, because it's dangerous. Social media has also altered the dynamic. "A lot of it is about the phone," says Rivers. "Fans used to heckle to get under a player's skin. Now it's about engagement farming and creating a viral moment, which has led to more bold encounters." Rivers, who played 13 NBA seasons before getting into coaching, had the N-word thrown at him in his playing days. Still, Rivers says the stuff he hears coming from crowds today is way worse. In February, Phoenix's Kevin Durant, after a viral confrontation with a pair of beer-emboldened buffoons in Dallas, said, and I quote, "They don't look at us as humans sometimes." Now, there's a flip side to that. Social media has thinned the skin of athletes as well. After a Pacers fan reportedly shouted, "Cancun on three," at Milwaukee's bench late in the Bucks' season-ending loss to Indiana, Patrick Beverley twice fired a ball into the stands in the direction of the heckler. NBA players, like most of America, are constantly online, endlessly scrolling through negative comments and replies. Some, like Durant, have gone as far as to create burner accounts to clap back. Before the internet, players were forced to deal with hecklers in the moment. When he was a freshman at Providence, Billy Donovan recalls regularly getting booed by the home crowd. "Didn't like my game," says Donovan, now the Bulls' coach. But the constant flow of faceless criticism today from, let's say, at Hoopheads 421 or Basketball for Life has created a heightened sensitivity. "Our generation is more equipped to walk away," says Rivers. A lot of guys today aren't doing that. Ficker pins some of the blame on the NBA. No sport offers closer seating to the playing surface than basketball, with teams taking in millions selling seats close enough to spill beer on the playing floor. "They try to sell propinquity," says Ficker. "They could always put up a barrier like they have in hockey, but they don't do that. They want to make money. So because of that, the guys on the floor have to steel themselves and just put up with it." Ironically, the blueprint for dealing with aggressive fan behavior may have been laid out by Durant. After getting cursed at while running onto the floor in Dallas, Durant confronted the fans. But when security moved to throw them out, Durant insisted the duo be allowed to stay. When you get a chance to let a person know how you feel real quick, then they'll backtrack, he said. "I loved how he handled that," says Rivers. "They should be held up as an example for what to do in those situations." The NBA, though, leery of escalation, will continue to take its cues from its players, even if the facts are in dispute. Doncic, explaining why he wanted the fan antagonizing him thrown out, claimed the fan had been cursing at him. Except no one, including a row of reporters sitting a few feet away, heard it like that. It's a story Ficker can relate to. In 1998, Ficker gave up his season tickets after the team tried to relocate his seats. He stayed away until 2014 when a friend offered him a ticket behind the visiting bench for a Mother's Day game against Indiana. Ficker, dry erase board in hand, showed up and immediately zeroed in on Roy Hibbert. Noting that the Packers center looked gassed, Ficker suggested Hibbert's mother give him a bath, even pulling out a rubber duck for Hibbert to play with. Later, Hibbert told reporters that Ficker was, and I quote, saying a lot of obscenities, end quote. No one heard me say anything like that, says Ficker. Players sometimes just make stuff up. 10 years later, Ficker hasn't been back since. But we'll be back next week. That wraps up this installment of the Magazine Rack on Chris. I've been reading from a special Olympic preview issue of Sports Illustrated magazine and from the Sports Illustrated website, SI.com. I'm Mario Cajar. So long till next time.